Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross Jr. resigned abruptly last night, sending shockwaves through the city. It was just last week that Mayor James Kenney called Ross the best police commissioner in America. Last night, the mayor said Ross's resignation was in the best interest of the department after allegations of sexual harassment and racial and gender discrimination surfaced within the ranks. The commissioner is accused of mishandling some of those accusations for personal reasons. WHYY's Ryan Briggs has been covering the story and joins us now with the latest. Ryan, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So no one saw this coming.
I think it's fair to say that sources inside the mayor's office, sources, in the upper echelons of the police department all seem to say that they were completely stunned by the resignation. It also came via like a 5:30 p.m. press release from the mayor's office, which is, suffice to say, not how police commissioners typically resign. And Ross hasn't really said anything since then. So that's also a break from the past where there's usually some ceremony, a changing of the guard, right? This is more scandalizing.
What exactly is Commissioner Ross accused of doing or not doing here as it relates to the sexual harassment and discrimination complaints that have surfaced?
Yeah, I mean, the timing of his resignation comes along with an amendment to an ongoing lawsuit about the failure of the department to address sexual harassment claims made by police officers. And I suppose the part that's most relevant to his resignation is this amendment that, states that Ross had allegedly engaged in a, romantic affair with one of the police officers that had brought this complaint. And it is also alleged that he particularly failed to address her complaints as a form of perhaps revenge for, this affair that had, fizzled. So that's his personal connection to this suit.
Yeah, and as you read the lawsuit, as you mentioned, this is an amendment. So this was not included in the original suit that was filed in
almost
July.
A month ago. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So it was just added. And some fairly salacious details, not involving the commissioner, we should be careful
Correct.
To point out.
Correct.
But
not in the harassment part, yes, right?
Right.
And the failure to address harassment, perhaps as some relationship to, in a romantic entanglement with the subordinate that had, ended.
Yeah. And without getting into graphic detail, what are some of the issues that are alleged in that complaint?
The complaint is really far-reaching. I mean, there's a number of other police officers that are named in the suit. You have instances of groping, derogatory comments towards subordinates, people who were, I guess, denigrating women who were pregnant, I think, at one point. There's a section about that. It's really just a string of a litany of different complaints. And there are sort of two female officers who are bringing this larger suit. And it's only recently that Ross had kind of been, sort of like added on to that in a more personal way. It is aimed at, a very wide swath of the police administration. They're saying it's a cultural problem. It's a systemic problem. And there was a failure to address these lingering issues. And that's kind of where the mayor jumped off in his announcement that Ross would be leaving. Is he was also saying nothing about Ross's personal involvement with these people, but he was pointing the finger at Ross for failing to address that wider systemic culture of harassment in the Philly PD.
I want to talk about that for a minute. How big an issue has this been for the Philadelphia Police Department?
Yeah, it's hardly unprecedented. There have been a string of these suits. Some of them were very high profile in the past. We had written about the issue of sexual harassment in the department a year ago and interviewed a former Philadelphia police officer who I believe had sexual assault allegations regarding a superior that had gone back to the early 2000s. And she was still, sort of engaged in, resolving some of those issues. It's not new, but I think what the issue is not new, but what sort of makes it more timely from perhaps the mayoral administration's perspective is that they said a year ago, we need to address this. You need to make some cultural changes. And Ross is a cop's cop. He worked his way up the department. He has a lot of allies in the upper administration. He is not a person that you would maybe look to immediately for that kind of radical shift in culture because he is so woven into the fabric of the department in good and perhaps bad ways.
Yeah. So do you anticipate that we may see more where this came from, that on some level this may just be the beginning?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It would be hard to kind of hypothesize, but the interim commissioner, Christine Coulter, is named in the suit. And so there is sort of a bridge into, you know, this interim administration that's coming in. And so, you know, she's not by any means exempted from that.
Yeah. I want to talk about her in just a moment, but I'm also interested to know if there is information available about the racial discrimination complaints. What do we know about that?
In terms of...
Are there specific allegations? I know that as you look at this, the lawsuit that we talked about, you know, there's a lot of detail about the sexual harassment piece of it. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the racial discrimination piece?
Yeah, I believe the two officers involved in the suit, one is Hispanic, one is African-American. And, you know, that is also a lingering issue. The Guardian Civic League, which is, you know, coalition of mostly black police officers, you know, has repeatedly raised these similar concerns that there's also a racial discrimination component. There have been racial incidents in the department, and that's also addressed, you know, in the suit. Although, at least in the context of Ross and what we're talking about today, you know, that mostly kind of revolves around this the sexual harassment dynamic of it. But yes, that's in there.
What's the FOP saying about this news?
I mean, I think the FOP has generally been relatively kind to Ross, which is a little telling, perhaps, of, you know, his relationship to some of the older guard members of the department. So, I mean, they've released a statement, but it's not perhaps as cutting as you've seen them be in the past when they have a commissioner that they feel is not on their side.
Ryan, there was some reporting that said that Commissioner Ross offered his resignation as early as Sunday night and the mayor would not accept it and then obviously changed his mind yesterday. What happened in the interim or what do we know about that?
From the people that I've spoken to, it sounds like there are exactly two people in Philadelphia who know the answer to that question, and that's Mayor Kenney and that's Commissioner Ross. And so I think it is probably fair to say that there was, you know, a more personal dimension to what happened here. I would certainly be speaking out of turn if I said that I knew exactly what that was. But you can absolutely say that this has been an extremely tense summer for the Philadelphia Police Department. The scandal involving police and making, you know, racist or violent comments on Facebook, this extremely high-profile shooting incident in which six officers were recently injured. I mean, there's got to be a lot of tension in the department and between the department and the administration, which is also there with them dealing with, you know, each one of these kind of things. And now, you know, just less than a week's gone by and you have the commissioner implicated in the sexual harassment scandal. I'm not going to speculate, but I think listeners can read into, you know, what that all amounts to inside the walls of City Hall or the, you know, police headquarters.
What a difference a couple of days makes.
Yeah.
And you mentioned both of the incidents, the Facebook scandal. A number of officers were suspended with intent to dismiss. A larger number were disciplined behind that. Then you had the shooting just last week in Tioga. And Commissioner Ross was generally praised for his handling of both of those incidents.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think that you can also be fair to Ross in looking at the handling of the Facebook incident and saying, well, they actually are attempting to dismiss some officers over these, you know, particularly egregious social media posts, and that is kind of a break from the past. And so I think, like, in the kindest reading that you could give to the commissioner is that, like, these might be issues that, like, there is no person that could fully address or fully move the department, you know, an old school police department that has really been plagued by a lot of these issues for decades, if not since its very inception. Is there a person that could, you know, do the lift on this? And so, you know, it's possible that Ross is also a guy who just got hit with a lot of bad stuff all at once. The actions that are outlined in the suit if they are true, are indefensible. But still, it's a lot to take on, even before you get to that stuff. Uh-huh. And I think people did praise Ross for some of his handling, especially the safe resolution of the standoff, with the shooter that had injured six police officers.
He was appointed commissioner in 2016, mm-hmm. I believe. What was his reputation within the department prior to these high-profile events of the last few weeks?
Yeah, as I had alluded to a little bit earlier, he was a careerist. He worked his way up from the bottom rungs to, being on deck even before, I think, Kenny came in as a likely successor, a likely commissioner. Again, a guy who I think was viewed very favorably, at least by people who were in positions of power in the department. And he had been in command of a number of elite units in the department before that. He was a very known quantity. He had been a deputy commissioner since, I believe, 2005. And I recall at the time of his appointment, a lot of people saying Ross had waited his turn, and it was his turn to take this job. And so you can kind of draw something out of that, I think, about his long-term aspirations and how he functioned in the department.
Yeah. Ryan, you reported, I believe it was you, that the mayor is now looking to an outside firm to get involved in managing some of this. What do we know about that?
I actually don't know much more than just that statement. That's my understanding. And that's also, a decision that was made in the aftermath of the Facebook scandal that we've mentioned a couple times now. I think in general, that's just considered to be a good move because otherwise you're asking the department to, in effect, investigate itself. And so you want to have, some kind of objectivity, some sort of an outside party involved in that. But I don't have many more details than that.
You talked about how these allegations of sexual harassment are certainly not new to the Philadelphia Police Department. I'm wondering if you know how Philadelphia ranks, or how do we stack up relative to other police departments in major cities across the country? Is this something that other departments are grappling with as well?
I mean, it's tough to compare different departments, but I talking to criminologists, I've heard before that the older East Coast departments, places, and also including places like Chicago, maybe, that have developed almost centuries-long cultures. I mean, the PPD goes back to the 19th century in some iteration. It's a lot harder to address what kind of becomes this more embedded culture in the department, and people kind of hand that down to new recruits as they come in, right? And you're not a fresh face there. So you're learning from people who've maybe been there for decades, or intergenerationally, is a thing that you also see, is multiple generations of cops, cop families, and things like that. So I think that makes Philadelphia a bit of an outlier. I've never seen a list of the worst, but I've heard that from people, that when you compare it to, say, departments in kind of newer cities, cities that grew in the 20th century, say, and developed a more modern culture that was trying to get to some of these best practices for here's how we're going to do things and try to be clean and above board, that's a little bit better there. And I imagine that applies to sexual harassment issues.
15 quick seconds. Who's replacing Commissioner Ross as the interim?
That's Christine Coulter. Yes. Another careerist in the department.
Ryan Briggs, thank you so much. When Radio Times comes right back, we will be talking about efforts across Pennsylvania where school districts are trying innovative ways to keep students safe. Will they work? We'll talk about that and more when Radio Times comes back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowane. With the start of school fast approaching, districts across Pennsylvania and the nation are ramping up security measures. In the wake of the Parkland school shooting and others, many school districts are adding security cameras, others are investing in therapists, a few are arming their administrators, and one school district has chosen yoga classes as a strategy to improve students' mental health. Parents are taking measures of their own, including supplying their children with bulletproof backpacks and binders, all in an effort to protect them in the event of a school shooting. But will these measures work, and what's the thinking behind them? Our guests today are a couple of our own WHYY reporters who have been covering this issue for Keystone Crossroads and investigating the future of school security. We, of course, welcome your comments and questions on this topic. You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Avi Wolfman-Arendt covers education for WHYY. He's with us today. Jen Kinney is a frequent WHYY contributor who reports on trauma and school safety, among other topics. And you can hear her not only on WHYY, but on WESA and on Public Radio International's The World. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Tracy.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Avi, as you reported, these new security measures are a direct response to what happened in Parkland, Santa Fe, other places. How much money did the state allocate for this, and how were these school districts chosen?
So what happened, and this happened in states all across the country, so Pennsylvania is kind of a microcosm in this sense, was that lawmakers got together after Parkland and after the shooting in Santa Fe and said, basically, we need to do something. What are we going to do? Of course, all sorts of bills and policies were debated, but one of the things that happened was they said, we're going to set aside an unprecedented sum of money for school districts to spend on safety and security upgrades. And they gave it was wide latitude. Those could be school counselors. They could be school police officers. It could be physical security upgrades. It could be training for staff. They set aside essentially about $52 million. Part of that was given – there was a $25,000 grant that was given to every traditional school district in Pennsylvania. There are 500 of those. And then the most of the money, $40 million of the money, was set aside for a competitive grant program where school districts would – submit applications to the state and say, this is what we want to buy. This is how much we think it's going to cost. Will you approve our application? And that money went to about 230 school districts, charter schools, and technical schools across the state. So $40 million total. And so the $25,000 part of it was just like, here, take this, spend it on what you want
that's
to spend
gravy,
it on. Yeah,
right?
That's gravy. But the competitive part, school districts had to justify like what we're spending it on and try to sort of enumerate how much that was going to cost. Yeah.
So as you looked at the data and you studied the different choices that school districts made, we mentioned a couple of them, but what really struck you out of that information?
A couple of things. So what we were able to get access to through a right to know request was the summaries that each school district that won a grant from the state said to the state, like, this is what we're going to spend the money on. So these were the approved applications. It's not every application, so some folks didn't get money that they asked for. But these are the approved applications. And there's a couple of things. First, I'll put it in two buckets. One bucket is there were some things that came up over and over again frequently, and we said, that's interesting. The state's clearly looks favorably on applications that include these things. But the second bucket is more that those things in the first bucket were pretty diverse, right? So there was just a wide range of things. You mentioned yoga lessons. That was the Lake Lehman School District. Yoga lessons and training to help kids de-escalate and deal with mental health issues. But it went from that all the way to metal detectors and school police officers and things we would more commonly associate with sort of hardening a school target, which is a word that safety and security experts use a lot. So what struck me, again, was some of it was the specific uses, but what really was the vast array of things that were approved. And you know, I had one expert review it and said he it looked like spaghetti thrown at the wall. People were just sort of like trying to figure out what works almost desperately because everyone feels the pressure right now to make schools feel more secure. And that's really – and that's a big part of it. It's how do students and staff and parents feel about the safety of the school. So everyone is trying to do things, all sorts of things, to try to make schools feel safer.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed was that a lot of schools were investing in cameras, it seems, or in an increased number of cameras. And I wondered, are cameras really a deterrent when you think about school shootings? Because we've heard these examples of school shooters who are live streaming themselves or videotaping themselves, who want to be on camera, who don't expect to survive the shooting anyway. Yeah. And so what's the rationale then behind increasing the surveillance cameras? How do they help?
So part of it, I think, you're absolutely right. The experts that I spoke to said, like, cameras don't prevent school shootings. There's just no evidence that having more security cameras makes a shooting less likely to happen. There's potentially some value in terms of police who could tap into a more modernized camera system that has remote access, a digitized camera system, could tap into that while the shooting was going on to see where the shooter might be in the building. There's also some value, I suppose, afterwards in the diagnostics of what happened, where were the weaknesses. Maybe we can learn something from that. But I don't think, like you said, a lot of school shooters want the notoriety. They want to be on camera some way or another, whether it's the news cameras afterwards and their mugshots on there, or it's even while the shooting's happening, like you said, with sort of live streaming. So I think part of what those requests are about, and we should note that we tried to categorize in sort of a rough way what were the most frequent types of requests, and cameras were number one. About half of districts that got approval for this money said in part of their application, we are going to either buy or upgrade cameras or digitize cameras in a way so that they can be accessed remotely. And I think part of it is, like one expert said to me, superintendents feel like they have to show parents, look, here's a thing that we did. You can see it. You can look at the camera in the school building or outside the school building in a lot of cases and see that we are making school safer. So I think there often is a bias towards tangible physical upgrades because, again, you can go back to your community and say, look, there was this horrific event in Florida or Texas. What are we doing here in Pennsylvania to make your kids' school safer? Look, here's a camera. Look, here's a bollard. Here's a secure entryway with bulletproof glass. It's a way, again, a lot of this is because these events are so infrequent, it's about the psychology of making people feel safer. I'm not saying that it necessarily does that. You can see it might make people more paranoid. But the idea behind it, I think in a lot of cases, is just to show people you are doing something.
We're taking steps. Yeah. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia. This is Radio Times, and I'm Tracy Matisak filling in for Marty Moscowane. Jen Kinney, you've been covering the firearms piece of this story, and you reported last month that there are actually a handful of schools whose superintendents are secretly armed in the Commonwealth. Tell us about that. How did that come about, and why superintendents?
Yeah, so we don't actually know how many superintendents might be carrying guns in their schools without informing the public, but I was told this by a lawyer who works with a group in Altoona, and they represent about 50 school districts across Pennsylvania. And he told me that he had been approached by several superintendents who wanted to carry guns in their schools. Pennsylvania law is a little bit murky on who can carry guns. And so the law firm's approach was to go to the district attorney in the county where that district was and ask them, if this person were to carry a gun, would you prosecute?
Wow.
And he told me that he wouldn't tell me where these schools were or which districts they might be in. But I knew that the Indiana County District Attorney, Patrick Dougherty, was really supportive of arming teachers. And I called him and he said, yes, I gave permission to a school district to do that, which was an interesting moment because part of the idea behind arming superintendents and not telling the public is that it's supposedly a deterrent, that if you don't know if someone is carrying a gun, that maybe that'll give you pause before you come in and attack the school. The reason that the school district hadn't made it public or the lawyer hadn't made it public was exactly that. And yet the district attorney sort of readily told me who this was, which cuts back to some of the contradictions, kind of like Avi was getting to with the cameras. You know, there's a sense of, we think this will work. We want a sense of security. We want people to feel safe. But we don't have a lot of evidence that having people in schools makes them any less likely to be targeted or that someone will respond appropriately if they're a somewhat untrained civilian and a shooting does occur.
Yeah. So we know that there are at least a handful of superintendents who are carrying weapons, but we don't know who they are. What's the feedback from parents? I mean, it's public now that there are some that are armed. So how are parents feeling about that?
You know, I didn't hear from a lot of people specifically responding to that story, but I've been following really closely in Tamaqua, the school district in Pennsylvania that had tried to be the first to arm their teachers. And there was a similar moment in Tamaqua where there was some uncertainty whether they had already allowed someone to carry a gun. Turned out to be a rumor. Wasn't true. But at that point, you know, I was hearing from parents saying, I'm going to pull my child out of the school, telling their kids, you know, what to do if they felt like they were in a classroom with an armed teacher. So it's caused a lot of, when those kind of rumors go around and people can't actually confirm with their district whether it's happening, it causes a lot of concern. Yeah.
Tamaqua presents an interesting case because they decided to arm teachers and then dialed it back and decided not to, if I understand it correctly. What happened there exactly?
Yeah, there's been a lot of back and forth. So they announced in announced in September of last year that they were going to do this. The public sort of found out in October, and then there was a public meeting in November. And after that, the teachers union sued. A group of parents sued. They made the same argument, saying that they didn't think that the policy was legal based on the amount of training that it required. The district pushed back on that. The school board continued to say they were going to go ahead despite the lawsuits. And then this summer, there was this whole kerfuffle in the legislature around who can carry guns in school. And there was a change made to that, saying that private security guards who are contractors and not employed by the school or by the local police department, that they could not carry guns. And when the legislature tried to change that, they tried to open up a pathway for them to carry. It created this ambiguity. Some legislators were saying that the governor and the Department of Education said this clears up the ambiguity. According to this law, teachers no longer can be armed. But the Tamaqua School District, their school board, continued to interpret the law to mean that teachers could be armed. And there was a part of the law that had originally been in the first draft that would have made it very clear that only these certain types of personnel can be armed, and that was taken out. So for now, Tamaqua has rescinded its policy. They say they are going to rewrite it, but they intend to rewrite it such that someone will still be armed in the school, likely a personnel and not a school security guard. The thinking behind that being that someone who is visibly armed in uniform is a target, whereas someone who is anonymously armed cannot be.
So that leads me to a question from one of our listeners. It's an email from Kristen, who says, I have an 11-year-old daughter going to middle school in East Narriton and have heard that schools who decide to arm teachers do not have to disclose this information to parents or tell them which teachers are armed. Is this true, and what kinds of rights do parents have?
Yeah, that's a great question. And at the moment, parts of that question are not settled in Pennsylvania. If we look to Ohio, which is a state where they have been arming teachers since right after Sandy Hook in 2013, in Ohio, some school districts do not tell the public at all. They arm their teachers. They do not say that they have armed their teachers. Sometimes years later, they might say that they've done so. Other school districts in Ohio will do this on a very above-the-board public process, tell people what they're doing. In Pennsylvania, because it's not totally clear whether this is allowed at all, it's not clear whether schools need to tell the public that someone is armed. Probably they do. Even when I spoke to District Attorney Dougherty in Indiana, Pennsylvania, he said, yeah, I gave that school district permission to arm their superintendent, but I would have expected them to do so in a public process. And they did not do that. But in Tamaqua, as in almost every school that does do this, exactly who would be carrying a gun is kept secret. That is almost always part of the policy.
And I think that even when you take this conversation beyond just arming teachers, this idea around disclosure and safety upgrades, there's just a lot of confusion in this space. Like when I went out and surveyed school districts about their security upgrades, some were very happy to talk about it. And I think in part because they felt like talking about it and publicizing it was itself a type of deterrent. Like, look how we've upgraded. Look how we've hardened. Beware criminal. Beware potential evildoer. And some people, it seemed, were taking the opposite approach. We're like, we don't want to tell you any specifics about what we did. You have the summary. We're not going to tell you any more than that because we think almost the mystery is a deterrent. What do we have? What do we not have? Who's armed? Who isn't? And that is ultimately going to deter sort of this worst case scenario. And I think at the end of the day, we just I don't think anyone truly knows what works. And so people take all sorts of approaches. And again, going back to the data that we were talking about earlier, right, that applies to the types of upgrades people make. Some people choose door A, some people choose door B, and there doesn't seem to be any cohesion around what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. Confusion seems to be the only constant when it comes to the conversation. Let me remind our listeners of the phone number if you'd like to weigh in on this topic. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or on Twitter at WHYY Radio Times. That is at WHYY Radio Times. Let me quickly read a Facebook comment from David, who says, I've been a classroom teacher since 1980. I have seen ideas and fads in my field come and go, but I have to say, the idea of arming teachers as a way of dealing with our epidemic of school shootings is the single dumbest thing I've ever heard. I don't know if you've heard that repeated from other teachers, but we thank him for that comment. Another comment from Edward, who says, good for them. Bring your concealed carry everywhere from the grocery store to the movie theater. Better safe than sorry. I'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And one more comment from Marcy, who says, gun accidents in schools will be our next cultural problem. So, and I'm sure that you all have run across that in your reporting as well. Before we go to a break, just want to talk about, as the two of you have traveled around covering this story, how much support are you hearing for tougher gun laws versus investing in these security measures? Where does that fall into the conversation?
Yeah, well, as your commenter, the second commenter kind of alluded to, I find that a lot of what happens after these shootings, you know, the deep contradiction in American gun culture is that after mass shootings, gun sales tend to increase because people are fearful that more gun control laws will follow, and also because of this very deeply held notion that we are safer if we can protect ourselves from gun violence with guns. So I find that, you know, in Tamaqua, that's been part of the debate. Maybe we need more mental health access for resources for that. Maybe we need to think about guns, but I'm not finding on the local level that that's necessarily what people are talking about. In fact, people seem to keep trying to keep this from being a Second Amendment issue, and it repeatedly returns to being one.
And I think part of that is we know that there is in this country and has been for some time essentially a political stalemate on the gun control issue. There's some movement back and forth, but generally there's these two sides, they're deeply entrenched. And so after these mass shootings in schools, of course, that debate is re-energized. But I think politicians know and local leaders know that there likely isn't going to be much movement on it. So they end up diverting a lot of the tangible stuff that happens after one of these events is on issues that people can agree on. And usually that includes upgrading safety and security in the school. Like everyone says, look, well, we have to do something. Here's something we can do because we know we can't really move the needle on this other debate.
It's kind of the path of least resistance.
In a sense,
yeah. Radio Times continues in just a moment. We'll continue our conversation about what schools and parents are doing to try to keep kids safe in the new school year. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We have been talking about school safety. Classes are just about to get underway here in Pennsylvania, and school districts and parents alike are taking a variety of measures to try to ensure student safety. And we should point out that schools remain one of the safest places for children to be, for the most part. But in the wake of so many shootings, there certainly has been heightened attention around innovations that schools and parents can use to try to keep children safe on some level. So we have been talking with a couple of WHYY reporters. Afi Wolfman-Arendt covers education for WHYY. Jen Kinney is a frequent WHYY contributor. She reports on trauma and school safety, among other issues. And they have been covering the story for Keystone Crossroads and have written extensively about what the state of Pennsylvania has been doing. Before we get too much farther, I want to read a comment, a tweet from Katie that I think will set us up for the rest of the conversation. She says, arming school staff is a terrible way to deal with systemic safety issues that need to be addressed with investing in school counselors, trauma-informed programs, and infrastructure to help create healthier communities. And there is certainly, from what I've read from your reporting, an interest in these softer solutions, the counseling, the trauma training. Avi, tell us about that, how those solutions work and why there's so much support for them.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is, I think, easy to focus on all of the gadgets and technological upgrades that school districts are making with this new flood of money. But we found that not a majority of the school districts that won grants, but a significant minority were focusing a good amount of their money or all of the money they got from the state on things like counselors, psychologists, social-emotional learning training programs, trauma-informed care programs. So there is momentum around these ideas. And I think part of what maybe gets lost in this conversation, when there is a school shooting and there is a legislative and financial response to it, one of the things that happens often is that there end up being more counselors in school, in some schools, right? That's one of the responses that people have. And so these incidences and responses to them are changing the everyday feel of schools. Yes, you're more likely to enter a school and see a camera now, or have to enter through give your ID scan through a system that checks you against a sexual predator database. But by the same time, once you get through the doors, you're more likely to see a counselor, because I think school districts feel pressure to add those types of services too. And the idea is that ultimately it's very difficult to stop someone who is absolutely determined to carry out a school shooting. But you can try to reach that person before they develop those ideas and the type of social isolation that often breeds the type of person who wants to do something so heinous. And so the idea is that, you know, this an expert told me that we need more heartware and not hardware. And by that, he was saying, look, the cameras can't jump off the wall and form a relationship with the child, but a staff member can, and often it's that one relationship, that one link to someone who cares, that can stop someone from going down the path that leads them to become a school shooter. It's not 100%, obviously, but that's the idea behind a lot of this stuff.
So, and related to that, Avi, is a story that you wrote about a safety tip line, right?
Yeah.
That was set up after the shootings in Parkland and Santa Fe, and it was used, but not necessarily for the purposes that it was set up, right?
Yeah, so that was one of the other tangible outcomes of the Parkland response in Pennsylvania. And what happened was that the state contracted with a nonprofit group to set up a safety tip line where teachers, students, community members could call in about sort of a wide array of things, including, but sort of it was framed around like threats of violence at school. And they did get a lot of what they considered somewhat credible threats that they dealt with that had to do with violence in school. But the vast majority of tips were about things like bullying, self-harm, suicide ideation. And so part of what that paints is a portrait of like what's the – on the ground every day, what are the problems that students are dealing with? Sometimes it is they're scared that someone might harm them or their classmates, but oftentimes it's I'm worried about my mental health or my best friend's mental health. Can someone help them with that?
So it provided insight that maybe was not expected, but useful nonetheless. I want to read a comment from Ted, who says, I've been a competitive shooter for 30 years. Arming a teacher who does not know how to handle a firearm is dangerous. What training will they have to undergo? What certification? Jen, has there been discussion around that?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is something that really varies state to state. Again, because Pennsylvania doesn't have a clear law on this, there isn't a standard. What Tamaqua said that they would do is send their staff to Act 234 training, which is training for security guards to carry guns in schools. That was part of what the lawsuit was about, was that parents and teachers were saying that that is not an acceptable form of training. It just doesn't apply to teachers. But what several states have done, including our neighbor Ohio, is they've been using a training program called FASTER. It's a nonprofit training program, but it is under the umbrella of a larger firearms association. So I actually went to this training in June, and it's about 27 hours of practice on the range, some lessons in the classroom about armed shooter scenarios, and then tactical training in a school. So they actually have the teachers go to a school with airsoft guns and practice responding to shootings. But again, it's only about 27 hours Faster likes to make the claim that this is actually more active shooter training than police have. I think a lot of police would dispute that characterization. But again, it's not terribly regulated. So in Ohio, some schools require that. But I spoke to a teacher there who her school required that she take it, but not that she pass.
Wow.
And so there's quite a lot of variation. Florida just approved arming teachers. They're going to require well over 100 hours of training. So there's no one really keeping track.
Yeah. I want to go to the phones to Sean, who is calling from, I believe, Chalfont. Sean, welcome to Radio Times. Did we get that right? Is that where you're calling from?
Yes, that's correct. I was just sworn in as a school police officer in PA. So I think the legislature is pretty clear on who can carry a gun and who cannot in the schools. I think it hinges on carrying a gun in a school. You have to have a lawful purpose, which the feeling is that self-defense is a lawful purpose. But arming an average teacher that doesn't have any expertise in firearms, probably not a great idea.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for your call and for contributing to the conversation. Also want to bring David into the conversation. David is a teacher, I understand, calling from Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, thanks, guys, for having me. My name is David Hensel. I'm the dean of students at Taggart Elementary in South Philly. I'm also a member of the Caucus of Working Educators. My concern is that in Pennsylvania, we had, you know, the massive cuts that Tom Corbett brought about, and we've never made our schools whole. So, you know, what we need in our schools are more counselors, more bilingual counselor assistants, more climate people in the buildings, more people to work with the students, social workers. Without that, we're always going to be struggling. And I think in general, what we got to look at is like the toxic culture of, you know, white masculinity and the kids being hooked up to electronic devices since almost birth. And the kids don't have those positive, healthy one-on-one interactions with adults. And, you know, when we don't have enough counselors and people to work with the kids, you know, we're setting them up for, you know, generations of this continuing, and we need to break the cycle.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call, and we certainly wish you a great school year ahead. Jen, I want you to respond to that.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, you know, Avi had said that there are more counselors. A lot of schools are spending money on counselors. And yet in Pennsylvania and across the country, there's still a huge shortage. And to kind of to get to what the caller was saying, the ACLU has said that there are 14 million students across the U.S. who are in schools with police officers, but no counselor, nurse, psychologist, or social worker. Oh. And in Pennsylvania, we have 380 students to every one counselor. So, and I think that, you know, this came up a lot in Tamaqua around the debate. There were parents and teachers who didn't want to see teachers armed would say we would rather invest in counseling, we'd rather invest in guidance. But the response to that was always, well, what do you do once there is a shooter through the door? And I think that has stymied a lot of progress on this front, that when people imagine the worst case scenario, they imagine it happening right now. And there's no sense that there's time to work on the longer term mental health of our students, which of course helps everyone.
Yeah. Question here from Kristen, who says, is it true that insurance companies will not cover the schools and teachers that are armed? Have either of you come across that in your reporting, Jen?
Again, it varies state to state. Kansas actually passed a law to arm teachers and then has never been able to implement it because their insurance company has said they will drop anyone.
Wow.
But Ohio has been able to do it, and their schools have not gone uninsured. Right now, we don't totally know how risky this is, and so insurance companies are really taking it situation by situation.
Yeah. Avi, I want to talk about what parents are doing, because we've talked at length about school districts and the variety of measures that they're taking, but you're hearing a lot about bulletproof backpacks, bulletproof binders, inserts that go in your backpack, hoodies. What do we know about that, and how effective those methods may or may not be?
We know it's a thing. We know that some companies are promoting this types of technology and a sort of, I guess, wearable safety. Effectiveness with all of this is so, so hard to gauge, because ultimately what a lot of this stuff by sort of ostensibly is aimed at, Whether this is how it's used or not, it's ostensibly aimed at stopping school shootings and deaths from school shootings. And because these incidences are so rare, it's almost impossible to establish any sort of pattern about what works. I've looked at the data of sort of homicides in school buildings over the last 15 years. You know, researchers have collated this stuff, and it just looks like a heartbeat monitor. It's just up and down, because ultimately, if there's 30 deaths in 1 year or 5 deaths in another, it might be just one incident that's swinging those numbers one way or the other. And so effectiveness is really, really difficult to gauge. One thing we can say is that national data suggests that the number of not necessarily violent incidences, but things like theft, crime in schools, since the early 90s has fallen. But it's fallen apace with crime out of schools. So does that have to do with these security updates in schools, or just the fact that crime seems to be down in society at large? It's really, really difficult to tell. It's really hard to isolate and untangle the effectiveness of these school safety measures, because again, they are aimed at stopping something, or stopping the sort of reducing the lethal nature of something that is in itself as rare as a lightning strike death.
And I think the really important question to ask about that is, you know, when schools are investing in things like security cameras, like more police officers, what are the unintended consequences of that? Dr. Peter Langman, who's a psychologist here in Pennsylvania, has said your chance of a school having a shooting is about one in every 10,000 years it's going to happen at your school. And yet, if you have more police officers, you have more cameras, student arrests are likely to go up, particularly students of color. So even though the school might never experience a shooting, all of these safety investments are impacting students in really
There's
real
a whole
ways.
Other side to all of those protections.
Yeah, right? I think there's a huge day-to-day impact to all of this stuff. And some people, let's be clear, think it's a very positive impact. I talked to one school official in the Reading-Muhlenberg area who said, like, look, we didn't used to have cameras. Now we have cameras, and we feel like our students are better behaved now because they know they can't get away with stuff. Now, again, everything here is anecdotal. We're just in a world of anecdotes here, because it's very, very difficult to establish whether this stuff works. Some people, there isn't a lot of specific research about school surveillance and its effectiveness. There is research about surveillance in general in places like China and Great Britain, where they've added cameras in sort of public places. And the research, it seems, suggests that it doesn't really deter crime or wrongdoing on a large scale. But again, we don't know a lot about specifically the school environment and how these things that we know are going to affect the day-to-day lives of students in all sorts of ways, we don't know a whole ton about whether they work or not.
Yeah. I want to talk about what students are trained to do. I remember the days of fire drills, and that was the extent of it, and now active shooter drills and that sort of thing. What do we know about how students are being trained in the event of an active shooter, whether it's in Pennsylvania or one of the other areas that you have investigated?
I know that one training that's gotten really popular is the ALICE training, and that is pretty widely used in Pennsylvania schools. It's similar to another concept, run, hide, fight, the idea being that you should try to get away if you can. If you cannot get away, you should hide, and the last sort of resort would be to try and fight back in various ways. So sort of famously, Blue Mountain School District in Pennsylvania, they were putting buckets of rocks in their classroom to throw at an intruder.
Yeah.
And that was part of this kind of this run, hide, fight idea. That's also been somewhat controversial. It's actually something I'm about to start looking into. When I spoke to some parents in Tamaqua, they were really upset that their youngest children in the elementary school had been told, and this is kind of standard ALICE training, that they were being trained that if, like, a tiger came in the door, what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents were really concerned that they were just not understanding what was actually being asked of them, but at the same time really didn't want their elementary school students to be told we're preparing for a possibility of a shooter. So actually trying to convey this to children is a big challenge, and I think parents do not feel totally comfortable with a lot of it.
These drills, active shooter drills, are like wallpaper now in schools. I mean, they're all over the place. I remember talking to a teacher who had first and third graders in a Pennsylvania school district, and she said, look, I just lie to them. I don't tell them what it's for. I hope that if it ever happens, we've prepared for this thing, and they know just to follow my instructions. But look, at the end of the day, this is, again, part of how all of this is changing the day-to-day in schools everywhere. Yeah. You know, these active shooter trainings are just a part of school life now.
Yeah, I have nieces who have told me that they were told to bring in canned goods to throw at a potential active shooter. So lots of different ways of approaching it. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, I want to thank you so much. Jen Kinney, thank you both for the great reporting that you have done on this issue. We will be watching and reading your stories for a long time to come on this, I'm sure. Want to thank you both for being with us. Our producers today have been John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM.